Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast, your source for current issues within the legal practice. Today, the Federalist Society's Administrative Law Practice Group is hosting a panel debate discussion on the Consumer Product Safety Improvement Act of 2008 and how it affects the Consumer Product Safety Commission. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speakers. So I would like to introduce myself. I'm Hal Stratton. I am senior counsel at Brownstein, Hyatt, Farber, Schreck in Albuquerque and Washington, D.C., and I'll be moderating the debate today. I'm also an executive committee member of the Federalist Society's Administrative Law and Regulation Practice Group. And I suppose just as a disclaimer, I should point out I'm former chairman of the Consumer Product Safety Commission and served there between 2002 and 2006. And I'm very honored today because I think we have two of the best, if not the best, experts on the Consumer Product Safety Commission to discuss this issue today. And I will introduce them in turn. The first is the Honorable Nancy Nord. She's a current Republican commissioner on the commission, and she's served since May 2005, and her term will go through October of 2012. Nancy is a former acting chairman of the commission, serving in that capacity from July 2006 to May 2009. Nancy's from Sioux Falls, South Dakota. She's got a bachelor's degree from the University of Nebraska and a law degree from George Washington University. She's held a number of government positions, including General Counsel of the White House Council on Environmental Quality, Counsel to the Commerce Committee of the U.S. House of Representatives, and attorney at the Federal Trade Commission. She's also been in the private sector, where she's been Director of Federal Affairs for Eastman Kodak, an attorney at Venner, Lipford, Bernhard, McPherson, and Hand in Washington, Executive Director of the American Corporate Counsel Association, and Director of Consumer Affairs for the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. We also have with us Commissioner Robert Adler, and I may call him Bob from time to time because that's what he goes by. He's a Democrat member of the commission, and he came to the commission in August of 2009, and his term goes through October 2014. He has a political science degree from the University of Pennsylvania and a JD from the University of Michigan. Prior to coming to the commission, he was professor of legal studies at the University of North Carolina and associate dean of the MBA program at the University of North Carolina, and as that, he was associate dean for the school's Bachelor of Science in Business Administration program. Prior to his service at UNC, Bob spent 9 years as an attorney advisor to two commissioners at the Consumer Product Safety Commission. He's also served on the Hill on the Subcommittee on Health and Environment of the Committee on Energy and Energy and Commerce in the U.S. House of Representatives. He's been Deputy Attorney General in Pennsylvania at the Pennsylvania AG's office, and he's been elected 6 times to the Board of Directors of Consumers Union. So those are the credentials of our two very distinguished and knowledgeable panelists today. Our topic today is the current state of the CPSC, the new Consumer Product Safety Improvement Act, and I say new, it was enacted in 2008, and how that act has affected the CPSC. And I'm just going to give a brief background of the CPSC for those listening who are not as familiar with it as some of the rest of us are. The CPSC was created by Congress in 1972 and actually came into existence in May of 1973. On the website, the CPSC gives its mission or an overview of the mission as the U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission is charged with protecting the public from unreasonable risks of serious injury or death from thousands of types of consumer products under the agency's jurisdiction. Now, the CPSC has jurisdiction over all those consumer products, but some products are not included in the jurisdiction, and that would include products like airplanes, boats, tobacco, alcohol, firearms, automobiles or automobile parts, food and drugs, and fixed-site amusement park rides. Now, the agency grew from 1973 to be about twice the size as it started into the early 80s. But in 1981, Congress passed some amendments that significantly changed the authority and administration at the commission and ended up in basically halving the numbers of staff at the CPSC eventually as that legislation went in place. Then, in 1986, the Congress decided through the appropriation of process to reduce the commission from a 5-member commission to a 3-member commission. Then, probably the broadest sweep was the Consumer Product Safety Improvement Act, which was passed or enacted in August of 2008. That actually restored the commission to 5 members and did a lot of other things, which we're going to talk about today. And there is, I might add, at this recording, pending legislation to provide some amendments to the most recent CPSIA. So that's just a brief introduction, and we're going to allow each of the commissioners up to 10 minutes for opening statements. We'll then have 2 minutes to respond by each if that's needed, and then we'll go into questions, answers, and discussion, and we'll allow each of the commissioners to sum up at the end. So we've decided that we will go by seniority, and since Commissioner Nord has been on the commission for some time now, I'll turn it over to her.
Thank you so much, Hal, and thanks to the Federalist Society for making this possible. It's really great to be here today and to get to discuss with my fellow commissioner and very good personal friend, Bob Adler, the job that we have been entrusted with by the American public, and that is to protect consumers from unreasonable risks of injury associated with consumer products. I think that I can speak for both of us by saying that we really couldn't be more enthused, more engaged, and more genuinely interested in getting the job done and getting the job done right. Although I suspect today we're going to have a few differing opinions about how to get it all done, I really do welcome this kind of dialogue with Bob because it gives us a really good opportunity to listen to each other, explore, reflect, and comment on each other's ideas. And I have to say that I always learn something when I talk with Bob Adler. At the CPSC, our task is huge, and we have a very small team to do that huge task. But we have some of the world's best scientists, engineers, toxicologists, and a growing stable of lawyers who are helping us get the job done and get it done right. This team has been working diligently for years with a central approach to protecting the consumer, and that approach is that we look at risk to the consumer and exposure. And weighing those two elements, we come up with a safety agenda that we address. As we'll discuss, I suspect, in a few minutes, our new law, the CPSIA, was a combined effort by many of us to enhance the agency's ability to protect the consumer. When I was the acting chairman of the agency, I sent up a list to Congress of suggested improvements for them to consider, and many of those were adopted in the final law. But what we got went well beyond what we asked for. Unfortunately, the CPSIA has locked us into a regulatory approach that makes risk and exposure, our two main tools, pretty irrelevant with respect to what we're regulating. And the result is that we are regulating things that don't necessarily present a real safety concern to consumers. The law also did not give us the flexibility that we needed to address the unintended consequences that we have seen flow from this law. As I was reflecting on this podcast today, for some reason, Robert Fulghum's book came to mind. His book is Everything I Need to Know I Learned in Kindergarten. And a lot of that, of course, is very fluffy, cotton candy type insights. But there is some wisdom that I think could apply here. He does set out some very interesting lessons. First of all, the first lesson is don't overreact. And unfortunately, with the CPSIA, Congress did precisely that. Second lesson is, if something's broke, fix it. And the third lesson is, if you fix it, make sure that it's a real fix. The CPSIA, in my opinion, while it was very well intended and has some good things, has ended up, through overreacting to the circumstances at the time, to have a number of unintended consequences that don't really advance safety and have cost billions of dollars in terms of American jobs, lost productivity, and wasted inventory. It's broke, and it needs to be fixed. But we need to make sure that the fix really works. And what's on the table right now is a good effort at starting that process, but it is not the fix that we need. So I will look forward to talking in more detail about some of the problems of the CPSIA and, I think, more productive ways to get the job done. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Nancy. Bob?
Well, thanks very much, and it's a pleasure to be on the phone with my good friend Nancy, and I would respond to her comments by saying that it's been a delight to sit down and talk to her and debate the issues relating to the Consumer Product Safety Commission over the months I've been here. And I appreciate the invitation to participate in this podcast. I realize the current topic is the state of CPSC and CPSIA, but I did want to take about 2 minutes to discuss regulation in general. And the reason I want to do that is because I just finished spending 22 years as a professor at the University of North Carolina in the business school, teaching a variety of courses, among which was a course in business government relations. So as you might imagine, I've developed some thoughts about regulation in general. And I know I'm talking to the Federalist Society, where there will probably be a measure of skepticism about some of the points I'm going to make. But let me start by saying that I am a proponent and a strong proponent of free markets. It's pretty hard to be at a business school for all those years and not support free markets. But that said, I have to add that there really is such a thing as market failure. And I don't think you can always cure market failure by relying on the market. I think it's one of those facts of life that monopolies exist. Information is often expensive and difficult to obtain. Companies can pollute. They can cheat. They can lie and steal for years at times without serious consequences or market punishment. And I think anybody who's been reading the headlines about the financial meltdown of the past 2 years or what's happening in the Gulf with what clearly appears to be lax, inadequate regulation of oil exploration has to conclude that there are times, hopefully few, when government has to step in, not to change the market, but to preserve the market, to say we are not going to permit companies to gain an unfair competitive edge by lying, cheating, or by cutting costs by making products that are cheap but are unsafe. In other words, government sets the floor for letting the market operate. But then I have to add for all of our friends in the Federalist Society, the fact that markets don't always work doesn't mean that regulation always does work. There's the possibility of regulatory failure as well. And I think we've all seen that poorly designed regulation can carry a downside. You can get government issuing rules that are anti-competitive, issuing rules that impose excessive costs, and at times don't provide much benefit. So for regulators like Nancy and me, the issue really isn't the market versus regulation. It's messier than that. The issue is imperfect markets balanced by imperfect regulation. But that's the real world we operate in, and that's what produces major judgment calls. I did also want to say a couple words about the Consumer Product Safety Improvement Act. I generally like it. I obviously like it more than Nancy does. I did want to note and remind our listeners that this was a law in August of 2008 that passed by a vote of 424-1 in the House, 89-3 in the Senate, and was signed into law not by Barack Obama, but by President George Bush. So it's obviously gotten very strong bipartisan backing. In other words, 513 members on a bipartisan basis voted for this legislation, and only four people voted against it. But it is a very large bill. It's the biggest change to the Consumer Product Safety Commission in the 36 years the agency's been in effect. And like any other large, comprehensive piece of legislation, you get some glitches. Nancy and I agree on some of the glitches, and we don't agree on other of the glitches. And I'm going to end right now, but at some point I thought we would march through things we like in the law, things I'm a little bit ambivalent about in the law, things I have some misgivings about in the law, and some things that I think ought to be in the law that aren't there. Thanks.
Thank you, Bob. Well, I think that's a good place to go. Nancy mentioned that the Congress overreacted and that there needs to be some fixes. And I think the listeners would be very interested, Nancy, if you'd tell us, pick out your first, your top two or three areas of the CPSIA that you think need to be fixed.
I'm happy to talk about that, but before I do, I think we should recognize, and Bob alluded to this, the significance of the CPSIA. This was the first real modernization of the agency statute since 1981. It needed to be done. And there's some very, very good things in this law, things that the agency asked for. We got some new tools and we've been using them. We got clarification and consistency across our statutes. We got streamlined rulemaking procedures, and we're using those rulemaking procedures. Basically, we got more and we're doing more as a result of the CPSIA. So let's not say that everything in the law is bad. However, there are some things that need to be fixed. One of the main concerns that I have about the law is that it has really reordered the agency's priorities. And what do I mean by that? Basically, what I mean is that because of it, we've had to put aside an established agency safety agenda that addressed real risks that have been identified by our safety agency experts here at the agency. We've had to put all those aside in order to focus on issues that are called out in the bill. And the bottom line is that we are spending a lot of time and a lot of public resources regulating things that don't present real safety risks. And as a regulator and as a consumer advocate even, that causes me a great deal of concern. But aside from just skewing those priorities, the bill has had, I think, a number of negative impacts on the agency. I think it's had some negative impacts on consumers and certainly on the regulated industry. As I mentioned in my opening remarks, we are now regulating at least certain substances without regard to risk and not necessarily based on scientific evidence that deals with, you know, the health effects of those substances. The implementation of the law, the rulemakings that we have been having to do, and indeed we've done more rulemakings in the last 18 months than we've done in the last 18 years of the agency's existence, that's basically overtaxing the agency staff, and it's causing some truly safety-related areas to slip by despite the efforts of the staff to do more than is humanly possible. The law has destroyed thousands of American jobs and deterred domestic production at a time when we really need to be doing just the opposite. And it's got an unnecessarily complicated and expensive testing, labeling, certification requirements that businesses need to implement without a real showing that those kinds of requirements really result in any tangible safety increases. So I've got lots of concerns about this law. But in essence, just to sum it up, the law directs us to do things that we shouldn't be doing, keeps us from doing some of the things we should be doing, and really doesn't give us the flexibility to adjust between those two results.
Bob, do you want to?
Yeah, I would. Let me walk through some of the things I like. Let me talk about a couple of things I'm ambivalent about and some things that I have misgivings about. And I like a lot of the provisions. I like the fact that we got greater funding and an expanded staff, but as you noted, we're still about half the size we were 30 years ago, and we've got a much, much bigger task ahead of us. I like the fact that they gave us a public database, which is modeled after that of the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, that will permit us to put reports of harm from people across the country, especially consumers, on a website that should be searchable and easily read so that everyone will have a chance to look at this agency in an open, transparent fashion, to look to see what products are injuring people, to see if you're a manufacturer, whether your products are unique in causing harm or whether other manufacturers' products are presenting similar degrees of harm. In other words, everybody is going to see the data that is at least the foundation on which the commission does its rulemaking, and I like the fact that it's a very open and transparent process. I like the fact that we got some added authority with respect to imports so that we can now stop dangerous products before they get into the marketplace. I like the fact that they increased our civil penalty authority so that if there are serious transgressions and violations of the law, we can impose more appropriate penalties. I actually like, and Nancy and I probably do disagree on this, that the fact with respect to regulated products that we now require people to do reasonable testing and to certify that their products meet CPSC regulations. I like the fact that there, at least in some modest measure, will be a requirement that with respect to children's products, companies won't be able just to make their product, hope and pray that it's safe, and ship it into the marketplace, but now they'll actually have to go to some independent third party and have them say, we've looked at your product, and it's not going to go out and burn, maim, strangle, or kill little kids. I do like the fact, as Nancy alluded to, that they've streamlined our rulemaking authority. Were it up to me, I would have streamlined it a little bit more and a little bit more broadly. I like the fact that it authorizes state AGs, attorneys general, to bring injunctive actions to help us enforce CPSC standards. I think that will be a net needed and useful multiplier effect. I like the fact that they overruled the CPSC effort to preempt state common law tort claims when I don't think Congress intended that. And I like the fact that they've given some whistleblower protection to private sector employees who report dangerous products. But let me talk about some things where I'm a little bit ambivalent. Nancy said that Congress imposed a very strict set of requirements on the agency to take industry voluntary standards and mandate them. That is going to promote safety, but that really has tied our hands to an extent. It's substituted Congress's priorities for the agency's priorities, and at times that's probably meant that we've had to put some stuff that I would classify as a bigger hazard on the back burner and to move some other things, not that they're not promoting safety, but that I might have moved differently in terms of priority. So I'm a little bit concerned about that. And I have misgivings about some of our provisions. Nancy didn't use the word lead, but I'm going to. The legislation set very, very stringent standards for lead in children's products and in paint. It moved the permissible levels of lead very low, very quickly, and it made those provisions retroactive. I don't actually have a problem with setting those low levels. The public health community has called for lead to be eliminated or reduced in the environment and in our products for 40 years and more. And we all know how dangerous lead can be. And the problem is lead is cumulative in kids. And the problem is that when kids have been harmed by lead, the effects are not easily reversible, if reversible at all. So my problem is I think that we probably moved these levels too fast and too low and made them retroactive. That doesn't mean it's no risk. It doesn't mean there's not a serious risk. I think the public health community is united in trying to promote the elimination of lead in the marketplace, but I think they probably moved it too quickly, and that probably did cause unnecessary disruption in the marketplace. And another point of concern is Congress knew that they were imposing very stringent levels, and they said, if you get somebody that is in violation and they want an exemption and they can show that their product is not unsafe, then you can grant them an exemption. But the language in the statute that would permit us to grant exemptions is just way too stringent. And so that's one of the provisions in this Consumer Product Safety Enhancement Act that would give us greater discretion to grant exemptions to companies that think that know they are in violation, but they think that the noncompliance doesn't present a serious hazard. Just one quick thing, and then I'll be done. What do I think I would add? I would still give the agency more staff and more dollars. FDA just got an expanded field presence that's bigger, just their expanded field presence, than the entirety of the Consumer Product Safety Commission. I still think our rulemaking process is a little too cumbersome, and I don't like the restrictions on information release that make CPSC alone among all regulatory agencies submit information to manufacturers for review prior to releasing it. Nobody else has to do that.
If I could respond.
Yes.
As Bob noted, there are a number of authorities that we both agree that the agency needed. But he called out at least, I guess, four things where we have a difference of opinion in the list that he just articulated. First of all, with respect to the public database, transparency, sure, we all want that. In fact, the CPSC is probably the most transparent federal agency, even before the CPSIA was enacted. We want consumers to be able to have information. Sure, we all want that. But you know what? We don't want consumers, at least I don't want consumers, to have information that is not accurate and that might be misleading, especially when it resides on a federal government database with the stamp of approval, like it or not, that's what it will be, of the federal government on it. The rule, the proposed rule that we just put out there, allows for everything from the ridiculous to the sublime to go onto this federal database. It does not have to be verified. It can be third-hand information. It can be information that people happen to read in the newspaper or after a game of telephone they decide to call the federal government. There's no effort being made in this proposed rule to assure that what goes up there is information that is going to be actually useful to consumers and won't mislead consumers. And I think that we have done a horrible, horrible disservice to consumers by not putting in place some quality control checks on the data that is going in up onto the federal database. Second, Bob raised the whole issue of testing and certification. And yes, I do think that it is not unreasonable to require that products that are subject to safety standards have some sort of certification. Obviously, you want people who are making and selling products to know what the rules are and to follow those rules. What the agency asked for during CPSIA consideration was the authority to impose testing and certification and third-party testing and certification in appropriate cases. What we got was this blanket requirement that it be done in all cases. And with respect to children's products, that the testing and certification be done by an independent third-party testing laboratory. Now, we're all concerned about jobs in this country. What I don't know that the Congress was thinking about was this new testing industry that they have developed. That's the only place that any jobs flow from the CPSIA. However, we are seeing these testing and certification requirements for children's products to have a real dramatic impact on the jobs of small producers of children's products in this country. If you read our regulatory flexibility analysis in the proposed rule we just put out, the CPSC staff states unequivocally that this rule, because of the third-party testing requirements, is going to have a real impact on small businesses. It is going to force certain businesses out of business. It is going to force certain lines of products to no longer be made. It is going to stifle innovation. And these are all things that our career economics staff are saying to us. So again, this is one of those examples where Congress just took what we asked for and really changed it in a way that turned a good idea into a not-so-good idea and really impacted our flexibility. With respect to state AGs, again, it's very useful to have more boots on the ground. Nobody is really contesting this, but what the problem is with respect to the provision that was written is that it really does not allow us to direct our own priorities. And we're starting to see some concerns being raised about state AGs going off in directions that are not necessarily consistent with the enforcement approach that the agency wants to take. So I think that that provision would benefit by language that would curtail the state AG's abilities to do things that are not consistent with the enforcement priorities that the agency has. And then finally, I'm glad that Bob raised the whole issue of lead, because that certainly is the elephant in the room. The agency has a long, proud history, as you well know, Hal, of working hard to protect children against the harmful effects of lead. Nobody wants unnecessary lead in children's environment, and the agency has just worked so hard over the years to address that. But the provisions that the Congress put in place with their focus on retroactivity, with their focus on such an expansive definition of what is a children's product, with an exemption process that really doesn't work, has made the lead regulations pretty unworkable, and they really do need to be fixed, and Congress should step up and do that.
It sounds like, this is Hal, and it sounds like both of you are in agreement that the provisions regarding the exemption, to allow the exemption for lead, needs to be changed in some way. Do you all agree on how it needs to be changed, or do you have different views on how it should be changed? Or do you know?
Well, I happen to like the provision that's in the Consumer Product Safety Enhancement Act. I think it's a very thoughtful and measured one, and it simply asks three questions of people who would seek an exemption when they've got products that are non-compliant. Do you need it in your product? Would it be too expensive to remove it from your product, from your children's product? And if you don't need it and it wouldn't be too expensive to remove it, then you ought to remove it. But if you find that you need it and it's too expensive to remove, then if you can demonstrate there's no measurable adverse health effect, then the commission is authorized to give an exemption. I think that makes sense. But I have to go back, if I might, for 2 minutes and respond to a couple of Nancy's comments with respect to the database and with respect to the testing and certification. Milton Friedman's my guide on this one. He's the one who said, give me the information and I'll decide what's useful or what isn't. This is not information that's released with the government stamp of approval. Far from it. The statute mandates that the commission certify any piece of information it releases as saying we do not guarantee its accuracy or credibility. Also, unlike NHTSA, we have a provision in the law that says we should look to see if the information that we would release, if it's demonstrable that the information is materially inaccurate, we're told we shouldn't release it. And I think that's a good balancing act. But we do not put a stamp of approval on it. And in fact, the information does have to be verified. That's one of the provisions in the statute. With respect to the testing and certification, Nancy makes a good point, but let me try to put this in proper context. The testing and certification regulations for the vast, vast, vast majority of business will have no extra costs whatsoever. Anybody who's a conscientious manufacturer is going to have a good quality assurance program, and I was at a business school that taught Six Sigma and all of these other provisions for quality assurance. The guys who are having trouble are the folks who did no testing whatsoever. And when you do no testing whatsoever and you have no idea whether your product is safe or not, then you're going to have a problem. I will say, and I'm very proud of the commission staff for doing this, the staff has worked diligently with the small manufacturers to not just walk the extra mile, to walk the extra 10 miles to help accommodate their concerns and reduce their costs. One of the things that the commission is doing is permitting small manufacturers to get products from their suppliers that are tested, and if the test that's been done by their supplier shows that the product would meet CPSC standards, the small manufacturers don't have to retest. They can take the testing done by their suppliers and rely on that. We also have lessened the amount of testing that's required. And the other thing that I think is going to be a sleeper and very helpful is the commission is in the process, as I understand it, of writing very clear booklets on how to comply with the standards. But the real problem is, and I wish this weren't true, it is not the case that small equals safe. Unfortunately, if you're small and you're not doing any testing of your product whatsoever, then you're using the public as guinea pigs. And I don't think anybody at this stage wants to say companies can make products and see, once they introduce them into the stream of commerce, whether or not they injure people.
With respect to the database, Bob and I think, just have a very fundamental disagreement here. I think that the information, once it goes up on a federal database, consumers will necessarily think that that information has been vetted. Yes, we will have disclaimers up there, but the verification process that Bob referred to is nothing more than sending a form back to the person that submitted the information saying, are you the person that submitted this information? It does not go to the accuracy or of the information at all. So I think we're going to end up with a database that is not going to be the kind of tool that it could be if we put a little bit more time and attention into setting it up right. With respect to, though, your question about the exemptions and the CPSEA legislation, I do disagree with Bob on whether the functional purpose exemption will solve the problems that we both agree have come from the CPSIA legislation. The new legislation would allow another exemption, that is the so-called functional purpose exemption. Under this, we could grant an exemption if lead has a functional purpose in the product and it is not neither practical nor technologically feasible to remove it. That's the first test. And Bob seems to think there is a cost aspect to this. That is not written in the legislation. There is a fleeting reference to a court case that deals with NHTSA that, if you read it carefully, you see a passing reference to cost. And there is that kind of language in the committee report, but that's hardly a cost criteria. It needs to be written into the language. But in any event, there is that first test. The second test is, can the product be put in the mouth? And the third test is, will this product impact the health and safety of consumers? I would submit that the only test that's relevant is the last one. If the product does not present an unreasonable risk of injury to consumers, if it is not going to harm consumers, then that should be the end of our analysis. We have no business regulating products that we have found not to be unsafe, and that is what is suggested by the functional purpose test. Second thing that bothers me an awful lot about the functional purpose test is the standard is maybe quite hard to meet, but in the proposed committee report language that is floating around, they basically tell us that there are two industries that they want us to exempt under this functional purpose test. And my concern is that what Congress is writing is a standard that is going to be very difficult to meet, that we are being sent a signal that we are to deal with these two well-represented industries, and then I don't think, frankly, it is going to be available to very many others. And in that respect, I don't think it is a particularly straightforward provision, and it concerns me the way it's being done.
If I might briefly respond, first back to the verification, the statute actually says a verification by the person submitting the information that the information submitted is true and accurate to the best of the person's
knowledge.
Okay.
And if they only have third-party knowledge, you know, that's of little meaning.
Moving on with respect to the point about the functional purpose test, I hope that if they enact this statute, that Nancy will not adopt the interpretation she's just given, because that's not the interpretation I would personally adopt. That State Farm Mutual Insurance case said something's impracticable if the cost of compliance is excessive, and that's the standard I personally would use, and I would hope I could convince Nancy, if they enact the statute, to adopt what I think is this more reasonable approach. But there's another point that I do want to say, and that is, when you're saying that with respect to children's products, that if it's not unsafe, not found to be unsafe, what this provision says is if it's not measurable in terms of an adverse effect on public health and safety. And there's a huge difference between saying something is not measurably adverse to the public health and safety and saying something's safe. The point about the law is that it is a reflection of this campaign by the public health community over the last number of decades to get lead removed from as many things as it can be, from our environment and from our products. And so if you don't have a reason for putting lead into a kid's product, what they're saying is then you shouldn't be putting it into a kid's product, because we can't say that what you're putting into a kid's product is safe. All we can say is, given the level of science today, we can't show that it's unsafe. But the scientists I've talked to a person, say, we think the mechanism in lead that causes harm continues to operate even when we can't measure it. We still think there's harm being caused. And I have a feeling that as science proceeds, we're going to find even these low levels of lead to be causing harm over time.
Well, the agency has been working very hard for years to address the whole issue of lead exposure to children. But the science that the agency has used is that you look at risk assessments. You look at the risk, you look at the exposure, you do look at whether the risk is measurable. That's basically good science, and that's what the agency was trying to do pre-CPSIA. The fact that Congress has put measurability back into the statute in this particular situation, I think, is a very good development. A better way of proceeding, frankly, would be to address the whole issue straight on and make the exemption provision that is there a workable position, a provision. And the way you would do that is through one simple change, and that would be you would strike the word any, which prevents us from looking at the measurable impact of the lead exposure, so that we can be focusing our scarce public resources on issues that really impact children rather than messing around with brass fittings and bicycle tire gauges and the tips of ballpoint pens and rhinestones and other things that our own staff people tell us, in their view, do not present a real risk to children. That's what we need to get that back to, and I'm concerned that the proposed change that the Congress is talking about doesn't give us the flexibility to get that back to that place.
Let me ask one. I'm going to ask one last question, and then give each of you a minute to sum up because we're running up on our deadline here. But I've heard a lot about the definition of children in the Act. It's 12 and under. Does that need to be changed? Is that the appropriate definition, or is 12 too old for the purposes of using it as a definition of children for purposes of the CPSC?
Well, I would strongly urge that the Congress consider changing that. You know, back in March of 2009, Congressman Dingell, who really is the father of the Consumer Product Safety Commission, wrote us a letter asking that same question. And I decided not to answer it as a political appointee. Instead, I put the question over to the career staff of the agency and asked them to respond to Congressman Dingell. And their recommendation was as follows. They said that we should lower the age limit used in the definition of children's products to better reflect exposure and then give the CPSC the discretion to set a higher age for certain materials or classes of product that pose a risk to older children or to younger ones in the same household. I think that that makes a lot of sense. It would focus the agency's attention in a more laser-like way on things that really present a harm to our most vulnerable population group, our children, and still give us the flexibility to deal with other problems as they come up.
Bob, what do you think about that?
It's an interesting issue. First, let me state what my understanding is of the reason why Congress put that age in. They were worried about what we call the common toy box issue. That is where you have younger, more vulnerable children playing with their older siblings' toys and acquiring an exposure to lead through that mechanism as well as through the playing with the toys that they generally play with. It's a judgment call by the Congress. I haven't seen any reason for changing that judgment call. I'm certainly open to somebody giving me some evidence that the judgment they made was incorrect, but I don't see that there's been major disruption caused by an expansive definition of age. But this is not one that I have studied at any great length, so I'm going to leave it at that.
Okay.
I can't resist going back to one point, though. and that is with respect to this notion that the levels that the Congress set and that are in the CPSIA ignore risk. The real issue is they don't ignore risk. What they ignore at some level is costs. This is a science-driven provision to drive these levels of lead low. It's something on which I have not heard a single voice of dissent in the public health community about trying to eliminate or reduce lead in the environment and in our products. But I think in reaching that extremely worthy goal, and I would find it hard to see that Nancy would disagree with that, it seems as though they probably went a little too quickly and they imposed it retroactively, which is something that gives me concerns. But it was absolutely a risk-driven determination.
Well, I'm going to count that as your one-minute finish-up. Is that okay, Bob?
That's fine.
Okay. And Nancy, how about you?
Well, I think that the problems with the CPSIA are becoming more and more apparent with every passing day. The CPSIA has brought about some real pain to people who make perfectly safe products. It's cost our economy billions of dollars. It has cost people their livelihood. And those people were not necessarily making safe products. They weren't negligent product manufacturers by any means. So the law needs to be fixed. That's the bottom line. Congress needs to step up, get the job done. And what is being considered by the Congress right now may be a good way to start the engine, but that vehicle really doesn't get us to the place we need to be. We need to get this fixed.
Nancy, thank you. Commissioner Nancy Nord and Commissioner Bob Adler, I just can't thank you enough for being with us today. I could go on another several hours with you folks, because we really have had the two leading experts, and for them to take the time out of what I know personally is such a busy schedule to do this, it's an honor for us to have you, and we very much appreciate it. To our listeners, thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For related materials to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia. Thank you very much.